Gifted Talks Fundraising offers you a seat at the table for a relaxed chat about what it takes to build successful giving programs. Marshalling decades of practical hands-on experience, the Gifted Directors provide helpful advice and top tips for achieving your fundraising goals. Hey, welcome back to One Mill Street. Here we are again at Gifted Talks Fundraising. And time's flown since our last session, actually, and I'm really, really pleased to be joined again today by Chris Goldie up from London and Amy Stevens from Leeds. Here we are, the three of us in the glorious Leamington Spa to chat fundraising.
Yep.
And today we're going to have it's sort of one of those sort of core tenets of good fundraising strategy and conduct is about communications, how you communicate, what types of tools to use, how to use your databases and how to make the whole system sort of click together, the mechanics, if you like, of good ongoing development programs. So Chris, there is a difference, isn't there, between your general ongoing fundraising and what you might do, say, for a specific campaign. What, do you want to just share a little bit about your thinking and how you would approach and shape those two types of programs?
Okay, the easiest way to think about it is almost the three pillars of fundraising, the three-legged stool. There are lots of different words used to describe fundraising strategies, but in essence, they have three parts to them. You have your annual fundraising for ongoing activities. Now, that may be some projects that roll on year, or it may be to meet your operational costs, so the unrestricted funding you need for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a consistent form of fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is ideally, in the case of a project, it might be 3 or 4 years funding for a specific project. It's the annual memberships, it's the events that you run, it's things that tend to roll on year after year and are repetitive.
Yeah.
You then have your capital fundraising. I think a lot of people get very confused between a capital building.
Yes,
of course. Capital fundraising.
So capital fundraising defined?
Capital fundraising is, the easiest way of describing capital fundraising, Andrew, is to say it's, you know, get as much money as possible from as few people as possible, as quickly as possible.
And for something very specific.
And for something very,
so
very
could
specific.
Be bursaries.
Could be bursaries.
Like,
could be building.
Could be building.
You know,
research program.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Okay.
And a good capital fundraising campaign will predominantly focus on major giving first to try and get as much as you possibly can, working to the Pareto's principle that we talk about so often, 80-20, trying to get the bulk of the money in before you then go to your broader community and encourage them all to be as supportive as they can be.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third piece of that is your endowment fundraising, the longer term, the legacy fundraising, which is an essential component of any fundraising strategy. Individual major gifts, potentially, depends again what the program is. Some outcomes are better suited to endowments. So bursaries can be a good split in a capital campaign between let's get some money in now to fund specific bursaries at major gift level.
Okay.
But also, if you don't want to pay for an individual's schooling for a year or five years or 6 years or 7 years or 2 years, whatever it might be, you can still make a significant contribution to an endowment because by a certain point, we'd like to have this amount of money, and therefore,
in the same way, let's say as a building, you could be raising money for an immediate capital through a capital campaign for an immediate maintenance program or enhancement program to a building. Equally, you could, if you were doing it from an endowment perspective, that third leg of the stool, you could be looking to set up a maintenance fund or to maintain the building long term and continue its
good care. Recognizing always that donors will give to what they want to give to, and there are some that want to give to buildings, and there are some that want to give to bursaries, and there are some that want to give to other projects.
Okay, so
so you keep that flexibility. An endowment fund is a very good way of being able to do that because you can either subdivide it, you can have one overarching endowment fund.
Yes.
And it gives scope then to give your legacy donors potentially something they know that's tangible they can give to.
Correct.
Okay. So those are the three pieces of fundraising, and your overall fundraising message clearly is to reflect what you're trying to do from that general perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, donor communications are really important within the specifics as well.
Yeah. So, Amy, across those three legs of the stool, you can have one donor be giving in to all three types of fundraising, and certainly through their time with the charity, that relationship can be developed using the communication tools that you choose to deploy at different times.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk us through some of the tools and how you would deploy them?
Yeah. So quite often, clients tend to impose a kind of one-size-fits-all communications approach.
Yeah.
And actually, with all the technology we have nowadays, we need to be drilling down and seeing, actually, donor X, what kind of communications do they respond to?
Yeah.
So there's different ways we can do that. We can communicate directly with our, you know, constituents, supporters, donors, and ask how they would like to be communicated to.
So what, by surveying them?
Yeah, by surveying. So some people still really like to get a hard copy newsletter.
Yeah.
Others might be more environmentally conscious and want an email newsletter. There's loads of different ways to consider how you communicate in that sense. Of course, there's phone calls, there's getting together in person, there's all these kind of things. But then there's using the technologies available to us to really track what a donor is responding to. So we've just finished a piece of work with a client, which one of our other team, Connor, worked with me on, really drilling down into how their database worked alongside their email client and how that turns out it didn't feed information from one way to another, which is
so
being,
often
being
happens.
Resolved.
Yeah.
But being able to learn things like, right, this donor, they always give when they've received a story about this subject matter.
Okay.
Therefore, we'll channel that kind of subject matter to that.
So it's really quite person. Bespoke. When,
very
if you can
bespoke.
Use your CRM, your database, sorry, to drill down and get that information,
yeah.
then you tailor and make a bespoke communications plan for that donor.
Exactly. Well, for okay. that donor or that group
that
of donors.
That group of donors.
So, you know, these
so,
people.
So let's say over 65-year-olds who've been regular annual givers
yes.
might respond to a legacy information, a story about someone leaving a legacy in their will and the impact that's had, that
yeah.
might be your target or your segment. Yeah.
But then you can also look at other types of messaging. So all too often, charities only use donor comms to ask for money.
Mm.
And we've got so much more to tell them, haven't we? So there's impact stories. You know, sometimes we saw it over COVID, we've spoken about this loads, where charities communicated with their donor supporter base just to reach out and say, hey, how are you doing? And had loads of gifts in return.
Yeah.
So, you know, that impact, saying thank you. So we're like big Christmas campaign, you know, you put everything out there on social, digital, you know, newsletters, the whole shebang. And then you don't give anyone an update with how it went.
No.
And somebody's given to you a Christmas campaign, you're thinking, well, did we reach target? Did we, you know, how's it been spent? What was the impact
yeah.
from that? So
yeah.
it's really planning your communications, not only targeted to specific donors, but also thinking about the spread of messaging and what you need to be telling your supporters.
And some of it too is about just taking a step back and looking again at what you're doing now, you know, producing in a school's context, your annual report, so to speak, your school magazine, if I, you know, isn't always the best way of reaching donors. It might satisfy your alumni base and provide a nice coffee table sort of reference or thing to have hanging around with your logo on, but it's not necessarily going to sort of open the wallets or reconfirm the gifts for the coming year, is it?
Where impact reports have become really important
yeah.
tools within that. So if I just take
talk to me about what
okay,
an impact
so,
report
so,
is.
So, you know, I went to a school that has been is one of the more successful fundraising schools and has raised a lot of money over the
yeah.
years. Every year for the last 45 years, I've been getting the school's annual reports, and it tells me what they're doing academically and how other sports teams are doing and what productions they're doing and who's died and who's, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
In recent years, through the development department and controlled by the development department, I'm now getting impact reports that are specifically about the money they've raised in the last 10 years and what they've done with that money. So in that case, they've rebuilt the school, they've opened new buildings, they've got a new theatre, they've got various bits and pieces. They've also launched a very big bursary programme, so the number of kids who are benefiting from transformational bursaries. So as a donor, even though I'm a very minor donor in the overall scheme of things, I am fully au fait with everything that they are doing through their fundraising. That gives me confidence in their development team and therefore makes me feel more inclined if I had the wherewithal to give them more money.
Yeah.
So it's that level of impact report that's really, really important. And
yeah.
if we go back to a client, Andrew, that you and I worked on a number of years ago, we pinpointed very early on, large organization that it was, there were no communications going out to its very extensive membership. So actually the members who were the people who you'd most expect to support the foundation weren't, because they really didn't know what it was doing.
No,
and
no
we
idea.
Found that out during the research piece. Well, I didn't even know we had a foundation.
You came
well,
to
you
surprise,
this
yeah.
This is what it's doing. Now, you know, as and I'm a member of that organisation, I get regular communications. Once a month, I get an impact update from the foundation.
But it's understanding too, Amy, the voice to use. I mean, I've been very impressed by some of the subtlety of getting third parties to reference. So where another donor, let's say, says, I gave to this because, and then I was so pleased to see this outcome. It's has more authenticity. It's more, we have trouble these days trusting institutions, even some of our most respected charities. And having a third party reference come in and say why they're, what their motivations were, what the outcomes were, and it sort of validates the case, if that makes sense. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, it does. And that's why people often like celebrity endorsement as well.
Yeah.
Because they see it if somebody's prepared to step
up. I'm always so wary with celebrities.
I know, we all
you know,
are.
I just don't kind of.
But it does, people go, oh, well, so-and-so's supporting it.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
You know.
And it also, in the modern world, it boosts the number of people that see Instagram
of course,
posts.
Of course,
the DM.
And the sharing. Yeah. So the sort of the secondary and tertiary reach of a communications program is enhanced by having a celebrity. I think equally important, though, and we've all had this debate with clients, is, you know, well, so-and-so is going to be our patron. Well, what's so-and-so going to do?
They're going to do, yeah.
Oh, well, they're going to lend their name to it. Well, that's not worth anything. It's not worth the hassle, quite frankly, of going through the process. You've got to be very clear what you want from your celebrities. PR, as a way of engineering greater interest in what it is you're trying to achieve, is great. It doesn't actually deliver the money. That still comes back to the core fundraising principles that we always talk about, which is cultivation, getting to know people, giving them a sense of ownership, and at the right time, actually asking them for support.
Well, that's the number one reason people give, is because they're asked. But
just back to the impact part of it. For me, it's all about demonstrating the impact. That's what comms is about, right? It's demonstrating the impact of the gift that they made and the impact that the organization is having. So again, this organization we've just worked with, some of the key feedback that came back on the survey was, you tell us things, but you don't give us the whole picture. So for example, they'd run a campaign and they'd said, campaign was really successful. We put in some recommendations and it's changing government policy on this matter. And a few people came back and said, put a link in there for us. We want to read more about what happened and read the nitty-gritty of the difference we made.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, right, okay, so they do want more information on that. So by kind of continually having that conversation and saying, are we communicating in the right way, it's helping them to improve their comms by really listening to the feedback they get.
Yeah. There is also an important role of informing as well as obviously validating. Mm. And particularly, I'm often struck by the lack of knowledge or understanding about charitable giving, how gift aid works, how, you know, legacy giving works, and the tax benefits that can come from that. Now, it sounds so, even people that frankly should know better, they're FTSE 100 directors or high-powered chartered accountants, but this is not their domain, charitable giving. They don't understand how it works for them personally as higher rate taxpayers in particular. And we saw, didn't we, HMRC reporting £600 million worth of unclaimed higher rate tax relief for people just did not claim last financial year. So you just, it does take your breath away.
Also ties in having a good communication strategy, because if you've got major donors and you've got a good comms strategy in place, at the end of every tax year, your donors will get a letter, whether they've given you £100 or £100,000, you'll get something saying, this is what you've given us. That prompts the donor to think, oh, if I store that away and I go to my accountant to fill in my tax return, there's the evidence that I've made that gift and therefore I get the tax saving.
It's also getting it out in a timely way. I've had those letters the following January and I thought, well, great, I've done my tax return. Yeah. You know, but Amy, that is comes back to your planning your comms, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Understanding in that bespoke way, you know, at this time I'm going to write this letter to this segment of this target group of prospects.
Absolutely. And, you know, the databases that we have nowadays and the way they talk to each other and can kind of pull that data through, if that's working properly for you, it's an absolute game changer in being able to plan your comms. So, and it really is a vital part for me. I'll be honest, it's one of the most boring parts of fundraising, because I'm not techie. So making sure all that techie side is working, I find really boring. But it is critical, because what is the point in launching, for example, a Christmas campaign and you're doing a, you know, big data acquisition program, if that is not drawing in the information properly into your system? So this person came through Facebook, so we know that ad worked on Facebook because they came right through and they made a gift. This person responded to the newsletter. You can't shape your marketing plan and your fundraising communications plan without that data nowadays.
Yeah, and you've got to have those KPIs, key performance indicators, yeah. Because again, you're learning year on year, aren't you? You're building on what the knowledge you're collecting this year helps inform and drive the plan for next year.
Yeah.
And if you're not clear about what those KPIs are, you can't actually improve. You're just going to keep running on the spot.
Yeah. So, for example, if your social media campaign performed really well, but you had absolutely no traction from your email newsletter, then let's next year focus more time and energy on the on the socials. And it just really helps you to shape your messaging and you know, who it's going to and therefore how that's feeding back into your system.
Chris, you and I are the older guys in the room, so to speak. I remember the days of, you know, direct mail letters being the big thing, and open rates of 4% were considered good. That's 4 in 100 letters were actually read. And I remember going to courses, and I thought it was hilarious. They were what's the order of things that people read when they open one of these letters? The first thing they read, apparently, unsurprisingly, is the name at the top. Is it meant for them? And then they'd look to see who's signed it. But what I thought was interesting, that it's not the content of the letter they read next, it's the PS, it's the personal note at the bottom of it. And it always makes me think that just simple comms from, you know, the leadership or key influencers in an organization, or a post-it note stuck on an annual report that's sent in the post saying, Chris, I thought you might be interested in story on page 6, actually gets through, cuts through.
Absolutely. I think personalization is really important. Interestingly, with direct mail, of course, we get far less now than we ever used to, because most of it is done electronically. So these days, I think we've almost come full circle, where if you do get a letter and you think it's of interest, you almost certainly will open it. So if you've opened it, what becomes the key elements of it? So make sure you read it. And that's got to be in your first sight. Is it addressed to you personally? So Dear Chris, as opposed to Dear Supporter.
Yeah.
I'm much more likely to read a Dear Chris letter than I am a Dear Supporter letter. And then, as you rightly say, Andrew, that little bit of I think you might be particularly interested in this bit. So in my case, if it was my old school and they were talking about the cricket facilities,
yeah,
and they pointed out that this is about that, I would be more interested in it.
Yeah.
Just naturally. So I think it's having that scope to do that. And I think we can now rely almost on the digital stuff to provide the overarching generic comms. But let's face it, we all go online. If I want to find out what's happening, I'll go online, I'll look it up. If you want to get to your major donors, or you want to cultivate those relationships, you haven't got time at this stage, or the individual prospects may not be high enough up your evaluation list to say they're worth direct face-to-face time, you can start to take them in the direction by making them feel a little bit special about what you're doing. It's part of that donor journey. So comms play a role at every level. And we're almost in a world now where the digital has replaced the direct mail.
Yeah.
And in the middle is the sort of nice, friendly letter that is a little bit personal. So you feel like that was meant for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the very end is what it's always been, which is that personal communication, that personal stewardship.
So we always have this debate at home about Christmas cards or no Christmas cards. Do people look at them anymore?
I'm a big fan of a Christmas card.
And I think they matter. I really do. Yeah.
I get highly offended when someone doesn't send me a Christmas card.
Oh, gosh. I'll bear that in mind.
You see, I'm lazy. So
but for me, it shows that somebody is thinking about me enough to bother to write a card.
But what about you?
It's probably really silly.
What about when you get these emails saying, we didn't send you a Christmas card this year, we donated to X, Y, and Z charity? And I'm thinking, well, yeah, that's really good. You should be doing that anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's me. Probably unfair, but
you're right. Again, it comes back to that personalization, doesn't it? I'm lazy, so therefore, whenever I get a Christmas card, I think, oh God, I haven't sent them one. I better get on and find one. And I'll have a little stock and I'll send them one back. That's reactive. That's lazy.
Are you a Christmas Grinch, though? Because I'm a big Christmas fan, I like writing my cards.
See, I'm actually not a Christmas Grinch. I'm not a Christmas Grinch at all. And, you know, I love the whole thing.
Oh, I've opened
Christmas.
That.
I'm just fundamentally lazy.
Yeah.
And the whole prospect of writing Christmas cards. You know, when my father died, God rest his soul, a long time ago, you know, he had a whole book of addresses.
I
inherited. And a list, a handwritten list of about 200 people that he sent Christmas cards to. And I
think,
bothered to do this. I'll see half of the people.
I think our listeners are going to find that very amusing, the differing views amongst gifted directors.
But I'm not a Grinch.
Christmas cards. Oh, well done, Chris. You don't look like a Grinch.
But this is why thinking about your audiences is so important, right? Because particularly the younger generations, they consume most stuff online nowadays. So if your KPIs are about, we want to recruit 2,000 new donors within this age bracket because they're really interested in our cause. We're going to, you know, steward them to become regular givers, you need to think about how you're communicating with people.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not forget, as we've mentioned, the power that cold mailing can have.
Yeah.
So I always speak about this, but I have now been fully got by the RNLI because they sent a fantastic direct mail. And it was just a door drop. So it had gone to everybody in certain postcodes, clearly.
Yeah.
And it was a fantastic piece of marketing.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I'm in. And now they keep sending me things and I keep giving them a tenner here and a tenner there. So, you know, there is still a role, isn't there, for traditional marketing techniques. Bear in mind, they can be very expensive. But in the right scenario, they can still work.
I've been taken with these door-to-door lottery approaches and thinking, you know, there's no tax benefits in this. It's not of the sort of fundraising I'm familiar with. But for a lot of people, that's a way of doing that direct response. And the big thing that was when I understood that they were solicited through door knocking. People come and canvass them on the door, asking them whether they would like to take lottery tickets. And we all know 80% of the time people will say yes to a proposition if they're presented with it personally. And because there's something in it in the lottery and it's well run, I've seen it in an air ambulance charity, it's a major source of income now for them. Mm. The difficulty I've got in some ways with it is it hits the lowest demographic, those least that can least afford it. And for a charity like that serves some very wealthy people as well, it does highlight different tools.
That is the challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and there are certain types of organisations, so air ambulance services and one hospice is very often or another, where they're very used to doing that sort of lottery type approach or retail type approach.
Yeah.
And of course, when you then start to speak to major donors, they go, well, I take all my stuff to the charity shop.
Yeah. And there's some good, there's my barber jackets I take in. But
I buy £100 worth of lottery tickets every month.
And we see
actually what you really want them is just sign a check for $5,000.
And we see that, don't we, in the giving stats, where some of the least well off, proportionate to their total income, give a much higher percentage than the most well off. Even though the big gifts from the wealthy donors are very welcome, but
so that's why you have to have really good overarching communications. People need to understand what it is you do and how you go about doing it.
Yeah,
but a really good donor comms program will recognize that every tier of donor, there's a different type of communication needed.
How are you finding, Amy, the videos? You know, the smartphone capacity now is like a movie studio in your hand, really, isn't it? And I've sort of obviously seen quite a lot more of that on social media. You could also, I assume, use it in a very bespoke way.
Yes. So I've actually got a brilliant example of this. It was at a conference, fundraising conference before COVID, chatting to this chap who was a fundraiser at a wildlife charity.
Yeah.
And they worked on a very regional basis. And they'd started looking at their direct debits and they had real drop-off rates at about 6 months and they couldn't figure out why that was, you know, that Mrs. X stopped giving her £10 a month at 6 months. So they got their park rangers to film little selfie videos saying, hey, everyone who lives in Leamington Spa, thanks to your gift today, we've been able to fund these 5 ducks and look how well they're doing. And then,
oh, how brilliant.
And it was about 30 seconds, a minute long.
And the total cost of Zippo?
Zippo. And they emailed them out with a video message to those within those postcode areas, their donors, and it completely stopped the drop off.
Really?
So something that actually isn't that personal, but is personal when you receive it.
Yes.
Can make a massive difference. Right?
And focusing on benefits.
Yeah.
Donors are driven by benefits. Absolutely. Yeah. Really clever piece of work.
Yeah. You know, they're driven by benefits and that benefit includes just that sense of satisfaction.
Yeah.
Mm. And that's, again, come back to impact reports. You may be a lowly donor with an overall large campaign, but you're still getting the overarching impact report.
Mm.
So you are a small part player in a much bigger piece, but you still feel, well, you know, I'm part of this. I'm part of this movement that's raised £100 million for this particular institution.
Mm.
And that's rewarding.
Mm.
And you walk away from it. I think the video piece, again, it's responding. It's much, if we come back to bursaries at schools, it's much more compelling to see the video of somebody who has been a recipient of a bursary talking about their life and what the bursary has meant to them.
Yeah.
I've seen one very recently from Eton College, one I've sent to me by a parent of somebody at Eton, they've been sent it by the school, of a young man from Yorkshire Way, working class family, non-white background, was at his local state secondary school, was clearly a genius. And the school said, this child is too bright to be here. It's just, you know, and they went out, the school actually went out and identified the bursary.
Oh, really?
So this kid went from you know, somewhere like Bradford or Barnsley, working class area, into having to wear the uniform at Eton.
Gosh, that must have been a shock.
He's still there, absolute culture shock. But he's now going back into his school and talking to the students. Mm. And they're using that to promote the power of the bursary. And I think it's a really good example of how you can use video. Mm. Most of the talk comes from his teachers at his old secondary school.
Right.
Saying, this has transformed his life because it's giving him the opportunity to shine. And it wouldn't have happened unless he'd got the full support. And I think that's a really powerful way of being able to say, we can do this. And it doesn't matter whether it's a school, whether it's a cathedral, whether it's a theatre, whether it's a hospice, whatever it might be, you can tell stories. Mm. And stories these days in the world we live in, whether young people meet middle-aged people or old people, you've got a couple of minutes to sell your case. Mm.
I'll tell you what comms I had recently, which I found really impressive. So one of my closest friends lost her dad. He was cared for at our local hospice. And for a birthday from our group of friends, she said, "Just could you all just make a donation to the hospice?" So I did it on behalf of our friends and kind of collected all the money. Got a thank you from the hospice. And I said, "Oh, it was actually made in for my friend's birthday in memory of Mr. So-and-so, who was with you recently." And they had that information on file. So without kind of compromising anything in terms of, you know, his personal data and what happened, she said, "Did you know that the funeral collection for Mr. So-and-so also raised such and such? So with your gift, you've now given us this and this will fund." And she gave me a tangible example.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, fantastic.
Wow.
And it was a relatively small, you know, we all put a tenner in each. It wasn't a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
But that really struck me. I'm now more likely to give to them again.
Yeah.
Because of how responsive the fundraiser
was. So now that raises a really interesting point, because going back to those three different types of fundraising, the annual, capital and endowment-based fundraising, we know that capital fundraising is best done through peer-to-peer asking, where I say to someone I know that, join me in supporting this. You know, I'm making a gift, join me and together we can achieve this particular project or program. So it's a very much a volunteer-led type of asking.
Yeah.
But comms, you know, you really do, don't you, need to think carefully about how often you actually ask. Mm. I mean, it's one thing to provide information. And I know there are certain charities that quite clearly make the decision they will only ask once a year or twice a year, and they make a big thing of that. Now, it's got to be thought through very carefully, hasn't it, Amy?
Definitely. If you, again, the piece of work we've just done, they were asking too frequently and not giving enough impact and other engagement.
Because it sounds like you're begging if you're not careful. Yeah.
You can't bombard people because they will just turn away from it. You know, I think it's really important that you recognise, it's the same with major donors. A few years ago, I sat down with the sort of volunteer leadership of a fundraising campaign and I said, "So what are we going to do for our major donors?" And the guy I spoke to said, "You know what? They don't really expect a lot. Let's just recognise them. Let's give them a degree of kudos.
A thank you letter.
A thank you note. A gathering once a year. They don't need to be. They don't want to be invited to everything. They don't want. All they want to know is that their money is helping the cause. They're doing it, and within a relatively local community, they want to be recognised as being part of a gang. And of course, that then helps to motivate others to want to be part of it.
Absolutely.
So you can communicate that on a quite restricted network basis. But if you go too, it's like anything. You know, if we get consistent sales calls from somebody. We're going to end up blocking it.
Yeah.
And the same with charities. And I think this striking that balance is really, really
important. So in your communications plan, Chris, you really do need to start by thinking very carefully about when you're asking and for what reason. And I know also even with the peer-to-peer major gifts and capital fundraising, sometimes it's about saying, I'm really just trying to achieve a first gift from a potential major donor that may ultimately be 5 to 10 gifts down the road will be the big gift I'm looking for. But it's the target is actually getting them just to make a gift.
And where your impact reports without an ask at the end of it just become really useful tools.
Mm.
Because everybody, you know, these are intelligent people. We're talking about intelligent people at the end of the day. Mm. They can make their own minds up about what they want to give to. And if they can see that the money that is raised is being put to good use, they're more inclined to support it.
Mm.
So let's take Amy's case there at the hospice. You say it wasn't a huge amount of money, but you had something tangible that you could relate to. And therefore, next time, you'll be more inclined to do it.
Mm. Yeah. The asking too much piece is critical. And I had one from a hospital charity that I was giving to. And I got a mailer with various other bits on, but also asking me to join the programme that I already gave to every month. So I contacted them and said, "Listen, I'm not moaning, but I'm just telling you because I want you to succeed." And
yeah, of course.
"You've sent me this mailer, and I already give. Like, people will find that pretty offensive.
Yeah.
And her response was, yeah, we've not figured out how to segment the database yet. Oh, so we just send the same thing to everyone. I was like, in which case, don't send it to anyone.
Yeah. No.
Until you've sorted it out. Yeah.
No, because it's a relatively small number. That I mean, we covered this in a previous podcast when we were talking about evaluation, prospect evaluation and rating. There's a lot of people that just will never give. Mm-hmm. And there are some, the ones you want to convert, you don't. And the protecting the ones who give now are the most likely group to give again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fair well,
it's
point.
Also
sorry,
a spin-off,
Chris.
Because, say, when my father passed away, he was in his early 90s, and we went through his bank statement, there was one charity he was giving to three times separately, presumably all as a result of some form of telephone or door-to-door approach, because I'm an elderly man. I will never give to that charity again as a result of that.
Really?
I feel they took advantage of him.
Yeah, yeah, fair point. Yeah. Yeah,
they should have known that he was already a donor.
Yeah.
Not gone back to him twice more and got more money. I'm talking about £2 a month or something. I mean, it's not like a lot of money. But just in principle, I will not, and it's a big, big household name charity, I will not give to them because I just feel that their system
and
we've let him down.
We've seen the impact of that, haven't we? And therefore the birth of a lot of our GDPR, protections. But it is a very fair point. And it's almost like you can't be bothered as a if you don't take care about the types of communications your donors are getting. And it's I think, quite disrespectful in a way. It's a very quick win to get that resolved because there's the group of people that would most likely step up and support you again if you approach them properly. So, Amy, do you when you go in and look at your annual, you know, your client and they're asking and talking with you about their communications plan, where do you start? Do you look at their database or do you start with what they're sending? And where do you start?
For me, it's understanding what their goals are, first of all. Okay. So what are those KPIs? What do they want to achieve over the next 3 years? Mm. Is it about a massive data acquisition program? For some people it is, and
yes,
they know
is.
They're going to have to invest in that. For others, it's kind of taking people along the journey to the next stage of giving or to launch a successful Christmas campaign or, you know, a specific project campaign. So it's understanding what their goals are first. And from that, you can then delve into how their systems are working and how you can help make that happen and what you need to communicate and when to achieve that. But yeah, what do we want to achieve is the first question.
That's a really important focus to bring. And Chris, thank you, Amy. And your final word really for you, when you're approaching this question of communications and communications strategies with clients, where do you start? What's your first point of call?
It's very similar to Amy. You know, never forget what it is you're trying to make people aware of.
Mm.
Come back to that motivation for people who give is based around the case for support.
Mm.
And, you know, you need to present that as powerfully as you possibly can because they have to take the decision themselves that they want to support it. And the way you achieve that is through good communications, not excessive communications, not communications that are telling fairy tales about what it might
look
like.
Yes.
Just honest, straightforward communications that sets out what it is you're trying to achieve. Impact, again, if you apply for a grant to a major grant maker, what they care about most is the impact their funding will have. It's exactly the same for an individual donor, whether they're going to give £100,000 or £10. They want to know that money is going to have some impact. Mm. And you can do that through your donor communications program at different levels.
Mm.
Get that right, and then you'll find the whole asking process becomes that much more easy.
It's the basics of being thoughtful and courteous and taking the care over the plan that you're putting in place. Thank you both for coming in today for Gifted Talks Fundraising. That was really informative and I'm really grateful to you for sharing so many live experiences that you're going through. So thanks for your time, Chris Goldie and Amy Stevens. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for pulling up a chair and joining our conversation today. Please share any comments or even pose some questions for future episodes by emailing us at inquiries@giftedphilanthropy.com.